You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. Today we are in Tortona.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Max, un arrivo un po' diverso stavolta, un po' in discesa, comunque il risultato uguale.
Sì, dai, un po' un arrivo molto difficile.
It was a very difficult finish. There was a lot of wind, so it was hard for Fernando. Was very smart starting his sprint late like that, because the finish was on a descent. So yes, he did a great sprint after some great work by the team. We struggled a bit in the stages in Sardinia. The train was misfiring. But we watched the sprints back, made a few adjustments, and now everything's going wonderfully. I think that Gaviria has the strongest team, but one outstanding rider in particular, Max Cerchese. Yesterday he dropped Gaviria off 100 meters from the line, but he could have won himself if he'd gone later, based on how he accelerated. So yes, they're the strongest train, and they've got a sprinter now who realizes how good he is. And that only increases his margin of superiority. Gaviria is a strange sprinter. I saw him in action 2 years ago. Then last year I saw him do something that I've seen very few other riders do, when Cancellara attacked in the last 2 kilometers of San Remo and Gaviria closed him down on his own, looking like a real class act. But then I also saw him following Quintana and Nibali on a 4 kilometer climb in Argentina. So I think he's more than a sprinter. He's really young and he reminds me a bit of Sagan in the way he rides. He's younger, perhaps not quite as good on the climbs, but he's not slow uphill either.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney and I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Lionel.
And we are speaking after the end of stage 13 of the Giro d'Italia, won by Fernando Gaviria. But there you heard from Gaviria's quick step flaws, teammate Max Richesi, arguably man of the match today, and Pippo Pozzato.
Pippo Pozzato, very prominent, the peacock of San Diego, wasn't he, in the finale? Lionel, we didn't hear in that clip, but someone said, Pippo, you tried to attack in the finale. And he said, no, I didn't try to attack. And I was thinking that that's what Luca Shinto has been saying for the last 2 weeks, that he hasn't tried to do anything. But he has been ill, and he's been vomiting in the middle of stages, apparently. But today he was in fairly fine fettle. But yeah, I mean, he explained that he tried to string the group out a bit for his team sprinter, Marechko, in the finale. Didn't really manage to do it. And he paid tribute there, really, to Quickstep and Richesi. He's a big fan of Richesi. I don't know whether there's some ulterior motive, because Pozzato is sort of contemplating life as an agent when he finishes his career. But I vividly remember Pozzato a couple of years ago singing Richesi's praises to me and Ciro, in fact, and telling us that he would be the missing link for Mark Cavendish at Quickstep, when Cavendish was at Quickstep, that Cavendish really needed to sign Richesi, but he didn't.
Well, Richesi's 34 years old, so if Pozzato's going to sign him up as his first client, I mean, that would be a very Pozzato thing to do, wouldn't it? Sign somebody up in the sort of the sunlight of their career as his first big client. But anyway, we've got about 7 mountain stages in this Giro to go, so I'm pretty confident when I say that this is the last mention of Filippo Pozzato this Giro, no?
Yeah, we have to get him out of the way now, don't we? We have to clear the decks.
Well, it's been a gamey 24 hours, hasn't it? Because last night for dinner, I had red partridge. You had guinea fowl. We were debating...
Again, very good value, though, wasn't it, Lionel?
It was excellent.
It was extremely
value.
Good value.
It really was, yeah. We should stress that. I don't think you can eat peacock, can you?
No, I was puzzled by that. I was thinking about this last night. I went to bed, Lionel, after our meal, with this troubling me. Why can't you eat peacock?
Maybe
when
somebody
you can eat partridge, pheasant, guinea fowl, red. Was it red?
Red partridge
that you had?
Yeah. Well, maybe somebody will tell us on Twitter whether you can eat peacock or why you can't eat peacock. Speaking of food, I mean, we're sitting in the dining room of our base for the evening. in the hills above Tortona.
Deep in the Monferrato hills.
Yeah, I can smell the kitchen. It smells very good, so hopefully there'll be something nice to eat. But this really is Fausto Coppi country, isn't it? There's a couple of photographs of Coppi on the wall here. Tortona is where Coppi died. That's where the stage finished today. Tomorrow morning stage starts in Castellania, where Coppi was born.
Smallest place ever to host a Giro d'Italia start. 90 people live there.
Goodness me, that is small. So I suppose we better crack on and just sum up what's happened on this, the 13th stage of the Giro, from Reggio Emilia to Tortona, 167 entirely flat kilometres. It was windy though, and I'll talk a bit about the wind a little bit later. But before the racing got underway, a few bits of news to update on. First of all, it's been reported that Bardiani, Stefano Pelazzi and Nicola Ruffoni both found out that their B samples were also positive. They failed dope tests in April and the results were announced on the eve of the Giro, and they pulled out of the race before it even started. And it sounds like both riders are going to be sacked by the team. Geraint Thomas has pulled out of the race. He's had a knee problem stemming from that crash on the road to Blockhouse and doesn't want to make it any worse. We'll hear from Team Sky's Dave Brailsford about that later. And although I did say yesterday, I think, that we wouldn't have any Tour of California news in the Giro podcast, simply because we're asleep when it's on, or eating, and we can't keep up with everything that's going on. But overnight, good news for Cannondale, because Andrew Talansky won on Mount Baldy. That ends Cannondale's two-year drought in the World Tour. And they were quite chipper this morning around the Cannondale bus.
They had a celebratory few turns on the front, didn't they, in the finale of today's stage and on the way into Tortona.
Yeah, apparently to keep Davide Formolo out of trouble and defend his 13th place overall. Perhaps they're anticipating him moving up the classification in the climbs.
We
coming
thought
up.
That they were just practicing their cycling ready for tomorrow, didn't we?
Well, it was a great opportunity to practice some cycling today, wasn't it? Anyway, Fernando Gaviria won his fourth stage of what is now a very impressive Giro for the 22-year-old Colombian. Four stage wins in his first Grand Tour. Sam Bennett inching ever closer to a victory, but he won't get one in this Giro now. Second place for the Irishman today, Jasper Stuyven third. No changes overall. And tomorrow it's the uphill finish at Europa, and really the Giro enters its final and decisive phase. So
interesting finish, wasn't it, Lionel? We were standing on the finish line and you could see just how much the road sloped down towards the finish line in the last 300 metres, which made it an unusual kind of sprint. And we speculated that it might favour the bigger, more powerful riders. We thought Andre Greipel might go well. But Gaviria, as Pozzato said in the opening clips, he's just got that swagger, that confidence. We compared him facetiously last night to Lord Flashheart from Blackadder. But he had even more swagger about him when he came into the press room this evening. And he's got a very strong team. And we heard Riquezzi talk about how they'd had to rejig things at the start of the race. I mean, it bears remembering that this is not a very experienced Quick-Step Floors lead-out train. There are a lot of riders in there who won't have done an awful lot of work for a sprinter in the past. You've got guys like Lawrence De Plus, Davide Martinelli. You know, these are young riders. Jungels himself has even been chipping in every now and again, and he's not an experienced rider in lead-out trains. So very, very impressive. And again, as Pozzato said in the opening of the podcast tonight, Gaviria is a very, very versatile rider, an extremely classy rider, and the sky is the limit for him, it seems.
I would say that today's win was the most impressive of Gaviria's four, simply because of the way he did it. He came from quite a long way back. Riquezzi undoubtedly did a great job, but he had a lot to do still, and it was the speed he had, and it was slightly downhill. I mean, sprinting, I've not seen too many finishes like that where the road is noticeably downhill. It must have been incredibly fast.
Prior to that line, it had been pretty standard fare, hadn't it? We expected a fairly quiet day, and so it proved.
Well, it did, but it was windy, and talking to people at the finish, that wind had a real kind of dampening down effect on the race. Nobody wanted to risk too much. These plains that we've come across today, very open and exposed, but going through the towns, of course, there's sudden shelter. So, yeah, you know, the wind was changing all of the time when the peloton was going in and out of the towns, suddenly was getting buffeted by wind as it came out of the shelter sections. And that made everybody pretty nervous, and no one really wanted to risk too much. And of course, you know, it's a game of kind of who blinks first, isn't it? So if nobody makes a real move, then everything will be fairly sedate. But I wanted to talk about the brakes, actually, because yesterday, if you remember, Sergei Fursunov and Marco Mercato got away, just the two riders on that really long stage. And we were actually talking to our Dutch colleague, Dan Hakkenberg, who said he'd been speaking to Sunweb's Tom Stamsnyder. And Stamsnyder explained a little bit to Dan about how the break went. The two riders went up the road, and then the sprinters team, so I'm assuming that would be Quickstep, Lotto Soudal, not sure who else, maybe Bora, then rode across the full width of the road, pretty much blocking anyone else from going in the break, because it's in the peloton's interest to keep that group small. However, we were in Bardiani country, weren't we, yesterday, and they were desperate to get in the break, and according to Stamsnyder, Mirko Maestri was shouting to be let through. A gap opened. Maestri then rode across the two-minute gap by that time up to the other two. The peloton closed the door again, and that's kind of how it happened. That's one of the nuances of breaks, and I think today we saw another one because four men went away initially. Pavel Brut of Gazprom, Matej Mohoric of UAE, Vincenzo Albanese of Bardiani, and Johan van Zyl of Dimension Data. Now, after a few kilometres, they were a couple of minutes up, but Van Zyl sat up and went back to the peloton. Quite curious, and I wanted to know why, so I went and asked Dimension Data, and they basically were just covering that break in case it got to maybe seven, eight men, in which case it might have had a slim chance of going to the finish. As it was, with only three of them or four of them, no chance of it going to the finish, and so Van Zyl sat up, came back, and then put all of his efforts into trying to help Ryan Gibbons in the sprint. And the young South African, who's only 22 and in his second World Tour race, got a pretty decent fifth place. But, you know, people might watch the stage and think, well, why do these little things happen? Why would somebody get in a break and then not go with it? And that's one of the reasons.
And it is a real science getting into a break. I get the impression, just speaking to riders and having watched the stages this week, that this hasn't been one of the more difficult Grand Tours, one of the more hectic Grand Tours at the start of stages, and we've spoken about why. There are an awful lot of teams here with GC interests and seem to be less interested in getting into breaks. So the break has tended to go pretty easily and quickly, which is unusual nowadays for Grand Tours. But generally speaking, it is very difficult to get into breaks. If you ever speak to Gianni Savio, of course, is boycotting the Giro. We're deep in Gianni Savio country. Gianni Savio, the silver-haired Dapper team manager of Androni Giocattoli. His team hails from the Piemonte region where we are today, but he is boycotting the Giro because they weren't invited. Androni Giocattoli, usually he makes an appearance anyway and he's in the press room holding forth, but not this time. Anyway, he has very interesting theories about how you get into breaks, and he operates this formation system where he makes sure he's got riders stationed on both sides of the road, because he thinks that that's where it's easiest to latch on to attackers earlier in the stage. And then he'll position someone in the middle, one rider in the middle. And anyway, he's got this quite elaborate strategy of how best to set up the team when you want riders to get into breaks.
It just goes to show, Daniel, that even on a day like today, when it appears that, and yesterday, when it appears that almost nothing has happened, there's still an awful lot going on in the peloton.
G'day, I'm Tiffany Cromer from the Canyon Tram Racing Team, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rapper. I ride because riding gives you freedom. You can see the most beautiful places in the most unexpected locations that you probably never go if you're just in a car or traveling around. It's a beautiful sport and everyone should enjoy it. My favorite ride is anywhere with beautiful scenery, great company, and an excellent coffee shop at the end.
The Rapha Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rapha.cc.
Thank you to Rapha for sponsoring the cycling podcast all year. A couple of things just to mention regarding Rapha. If you live in or around Milan, there are some rides going out at the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, celebrating the Giro d'Italia and its 100th edition. The rides have been curated by local riders, so they'll take anyone who joins up with the ride around the countryside around Milan, I'm assuming. If you want to go, sign up at rapha.cc/rides/Milan, and the Rapha Milan pop-up store is open until June the 27th, and it's on Via Fiori Chiari. Oh, we might be
a dog attack
here. Hello little fellow. He's just come out of the kitchen there, the dog. Rafa have also launched their Coppi flyweight jersey. It's available now at rafa.cc, and it's inspired by Fausto Coppi's first great victory at Abetone in 1940. It's designed for riding and training in hot and humid conditions, so ideal for the summer. The story behind the design is it's pink, obviously, because that was when Coppi took the pink jersey, and it has the tricolour on the sleeve cuffs and collar and the stage profile printed across the rear pocket. So looks very stylish as well as performing well. And we are in Fausto Coppi's home region. Fausto Coppi wasn't the original Pedaleur de Charme, but he would fit that bill, wouldn't he? And the results of our Pedaleur de Charme competition are in, and it was very, very close. I think 37% of people who voted for Omar Fraile. So he wins ahead of Geraint Thomas, who had 35%. Good job, too, because Geraint Thomas went home this morning, so we wouldn't be able to present him with the Rafa Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt anyway. But I will go and find Omar tomorrow morning and give
this
that
from
to
the
him.
First week.
From the second week.
Second week. What about Campanets?
Well, he was third. He didn't poll.
Do you know what,
well.
Lionel? Do you know what I heard today? That the Lotto NL Jumbo staff are not particularly impressed with him. You know, I mean, there was a lot of love for him on social media. I noticed those who don't know the story, I think he zipped down. I didn't actually see it, but I think he zipped down his skin suit to reveal, well, it was an invitation to go on a date with him to a particular young lady who he hoped was watching. And he did the same thing at the finish, didn't he? And she's subsequently accepted that she will go on a date with him. But I thought, you know, at the finish line, fair enough. But when you're on the start ramp, I thought it was a little, maybe a little bit unprofessional. Just a touch.
Yeah, I mean, he did say that he'd been told to take it easy because he's going to be working for Stephen Kruiswijk in the mountains, although Kruiswijk's overall challenge is kind of coming unstitched, isn't it? But, yeah, it's one of those ones, isn't it? It's, you know, it garnered an awful lot of attention on social media, but then I read that the boss of the team and the sponsors were not as enamoured by the gesture, and so then probably the team has got to make the sort of all the right noises and sort of come down a bit hard on him. But I mean, you know, no harm done, and he's got a
he's
date.
Got the date, he's got the lads done well, the lads done well.
Anyway, Daniel, I wandered into Tortona while the stage was going on this afternoon, really struck by just how much again the town has turned out for the Giro. Every single shop window seemed to have a bicycle in it, or a picture of Fausto Coppi, or a picture of Fausto's younger brother, Cersa Coppi. Obviously, this is where one of the great icons of Italian cycling was from. He actually died here. I mean, it's in our Giro 100 special, which we released on the eve of the Giro, William Fotheringham, who wrote Fallen Angel, the biography or a biography of Fausto Coppi, was very interesting. But I didn't know too much about, you know, the circumstances surrounding his death. He'd been in Upper Volta, which is now Burkina Faso, and he contracted malaria.
On a hunting trip? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, on a hunting trip. Contracted malaria. Out of season this was, you know, not when the cycling season was going on. Must have been December 59 when they went on the hunting trip. And when he got home, he fell ill. Raphael Geminiani also had malaria, and the doctors in France treated him. And somebody who knew Geminiani rang the doctors who were treating Coppi and said, look, it's malaria. And the doctors in Italy said, look, you treat Raphael Geminiani, we'll treat Fausto Coppi, you know, leave us alone. And Coppi died on January the 2nd, 1960. And it was a huge tragedy for Italy because he was undoubtedly at the time the number one sporting figure, somebody hugely important in the process of Italy healing itself after the Second World War and all of the split between more or less North and South. And I was really struck by the number of newspaper cuttings that were displayed in shop windows. One really powerful one, Corriere della Sera from January 1960, and it shows a young girl, and I'm assuming her mother, looking at the open casket of Fausto Coppi's dead body lying there. And he's a huge figure, isn't he? And William makes the point in our special podcast that the myth of Fausto Coppi lives on so strongly simply because he died young. He was still racing when he died, whereas Gino Bartali went on to become an old man and in a sense a sort of diminished figure.
Yeah, and the same applies in a way to Marco Pantani. We'll talk about him later. But Lionel, you talked there about Coppi being one of the great icons of Italian cycling. Another bad day for Italian cycling in the sense that they still haven't broken their duck as far as stage wins are concerned, and a doubly negative day in the sense that the positive test that really cast a shadow over the eve of this Giro d'Italia, Stefano Pirazzi and Nicola Ruffoni, well, they've been confirmed, haven't they, because the B samples have come back positive, and Bardiani is still in the race. In theory, a team that has two positive tests is liable to be suspended for 45 days, isn't it? But as the Giro is ongoing at the moment, that's not going to happen imminently. I spoke yesterday, as we know, because we heard from him yesterday, Stefano Zanata, the director sportif at Bardiani. We spoke to him yesterday about tactics in the race, but also spoke to him about something that Leonardo Piepoli, another rider who tested positive, but way back in 2008, had said to us a few days ago about teams now doing, well, the phrase that Piepoli used was anti-doping terrorism and being very draconian and really getting their act together as far as controlling their riders, stopping them from doping. But I put it to Zanata that the cases of Pirazzi and Ruffoni prove that it may not always be enough. And here is what he said.
I think we're pretty much at the limit of what we can do and what the law allows us to do. We can't go and sleep in a rider's house with them. You need one person keeping tabs on every rider. The fact is that there's a lot of work to do at grassroots level. The culture at that level has to change. It's about education. We live in a society which now takes more of its values from social media than it does from, say, a father or a grandfather. In cycling in Italy, the culture's changed a lot at pro level, but much less in the under-23s and juniors. It's still all about results at any cost there. They want wins. They'll happily take kids out of school to do stage races, and they want little champions that they can then sell to a sponsor. Kids of 16 years old. It's the opposite of what's happening in other countries. It's nice to win a junior world championship or a European world championship or a track medal, but that's still about results and not about developing the kids. You get director sportifs of juniors changing teams every year in Italy to be with the most successful kids. They're mercenaries, and it's absolute anathema when you're trying to develop young riders. You have to work with principles, not results. That's what's happening in other countries, and we're seeing the results.
So I think there is, in a nutshell, Lionel, I think the ills of Italian cycling have very deep roots, not only in terms of doping, but in terms of results. And Stefano Zanata there talked about how the French cycling system and movement has really got its act together over the last few years. And a lot of it is federation sort of promoted and based, and the same in Great Britain, and the same in a lot of countries which are producing good riders at the moment, whereas in Italian cycling at the grassroots level, you still have this sort of, you know, often it's inter-village or inter-town or inter-club rivalries, and the only thing that counts is victories. And, you know, we had a good laugh yesterday at Luca Shinto's expense, we do most days, but this is something that he said to me earlier in the Giro about Italian sprinters, and Marechko has done okay in this Giro, but you know, he talked to me the other day about the obsession with victories at the lower level of Italian cycling, and a lot of young Italian sprinters will focus on criteriums, circuit races, all in an effort to chalk up 10, 15 victories a year rather than developing themselves as all-round riders and competing on harder courses. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that Italy hasn't mounted more of a challenge in the sprint stages in particular.
Well, they haven't got a world tour team. The wildcard teams are doing okay, but they haven't got the sort of charismatic figures that we've seen in the past, and perhaps there are obvious reasons for that. I mean, you know, back in the day we saw, I mean, Emanuele Sella, for example, would have been riding outside of what was, you know, what is now the world tour level, you know, ripping up stages, and then, you know, we testing positive. So, I mean, in some senses, perhaps Italian cycling is going through what French cycling went through, but sort of a generation later.
Yeah, without a doubt. And they were very complacent, as we've said many times before. While they were winning, they thought that everything was okay, and they were really storing up problems for their own future. And that future has now come home to roost and come home to sort of haunt them.
And the Shintometer will have been off the chart last night because Luca Shinto, the Villa Tristina sports director.
You're going to say the village idiot then? That would have been very rude. That would have been extremely rude.
I don't know him, so I'm only picking up on the dubbed interviews that I'm hearing. He got fined for giving an interview on the phone to, I think it was a radio journalist, in the final 10 kilometres of yesterday's stage, which is not allowed. You are allowed to do interviews on the phone as long as you're not holding the phone. You're allowed to talk to TV or radio during the stage, but there is a rule about at the finale of the race. He broke that rule, got a fine. Yeah, so not a great day. Just changing gears completely, I spoke to Dave Brailsford this morning just to find out exactly what was going on with Geraint Thomas. Obviously, it was announced that Geraint Thomas would go home. It's clear that the fallout from that crash has affected him in more than one way. When he hit the deck, it looked like his shoulder was the worst affected part of his body, but in recent days, his knee has been troubling him. And here's what Dave Brailsford said about how Geraint came to that decision and what is next for the Welshman.
Pretty disappointing, actually, for Geraint. You know, he'd worked really hard to get himself in terrific shape. Probably the best shape I've seen him, actually, at the start of this Giro. Rode well, kept himself out of trouble, and of course we all know what happened. And I thought when he was on the ground, we all thought he'd broken his collarbone, to be fair, but he'd actually dislocated his shoulder. And then when he stood up again, his shoulder popped back in and he carried on. We thought, you know, it's a big old crash, that one. So thought we'd push on, and I think the shorter duration effort in a single position in the time trial, actually he did very well at that. But then the next day he got up and he wasn't right, and he had a very very a sore knee, and then yesterday all day he was in quite a lot of pain with his knee. And I think, so you know, we've got two or three knee injuries at the minute. They're very very delicate things, and it's just a big risk. And you know, he kind of debated pushing on, but I just don't think he could have done, to be honest. You know, he got dropped in the final yesterday. He couldn't. You know, as the pace went, he's got pace to, you know, normally, and so he really was struggling with it. I think it's a real shame for him that he didn't actually get to race in the mountains, because I mean that would have been the real test. He handled himself fantastically well, obviously, up until the crash, and we were just about there. I thought, right, his Giro is just about to start on Blockhouse, and of course that happened, you know, and so it is disappointing for him. However, as one door closes in sports, another one always opens, and so if he can, like I say, get his knee right and get himself back to the shape that he was in coming in, there's no reason why he couldn't be fresh enough as well, then I think he can start the Tour de France in great shape.
Hey everyone, I'm Ian Boswell of Team Sky. I would say my biggest nutritional tip would just be to fuel the ride, and I think that's one thing that I've changed in the last year or 2 years working with James Morton at Sky and SIS, is just how important it is to fuel workouts. And you know, sometimes you can get this mindset, especially in professional cycling, where you got to lose weight, so you need to underfuel. But you know, before big important training rides or races, that's not the time to underfuel. And I've come to realize that when you fuel a training ride, you're eating more, but you also can then go burn more. And you know, especially I've noticed the consumption of carbohydrates throughout a ride to make sure I can continue to do my efforts and continue to extend to the into the fifth and sixth hour of a ride. You know, it's really important to have fuel to get your body to that point, and especially if you have intervals in the last hour of a long ride, because essentially in a race, that's when races are won, or on the final climb after 5-6 hours. So be able to have the fuel in your body to still complete efforts on training or in a race after that much time is crucial. And it's also important to make sure that you're training with the fuel that you're racing with, because if you're going out and training with, I don't know, bananas, and then you get to a race and all of a sudden you have 10 gels in your pocket, but you've never tried the gels, probably not the best time to give them a try. So I think it's really important to train like you race, and to practice, and to get your body used to using the products you use in a race in training.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
That was Team Sky's Ian Boswell talking about how he fuels his rides, and Ian Boswell had a pretty good day yesterday because he was fourth on Mount Baldy at the Tour of California and lies third overall. So he is sponsored by, or rather Team Sky is sponsored by Science and Sport, who also sponsor the cycling podcast. If you want to get 20% off all of Science and Sport's products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code CPOD20. That's CPOD20. There's also quite an impressive competition with a really impressive prize up for grabs. The prize is a pair of Oakley Giro glasses, which you can't buy. Only pro riders can have those, plus a best-in-market smart trainer, the Wahoo Kicker, plus a year's supply of Science in Sport and Muckoff products, plus a signed Team Sky 2017 jersey. There are also second and third place prizes.
Sticker rock?
That's cheese. What? No, what is it? Fondue set.
Right, yeah. Waffle maker.
Travel iron. We shouldn't be mocking such a fantastic competition.
You bought me
here.
A travel iron, didn't you, on the way to the Giro? I'd left my travel iron behind and you bought me one. That was very nice. I need to reimburse you. 30 quid, wasn't it?
You need to reimburse the Buffalo. What a gear change this is. So, second and third place prizes worth £1,000 and £500 up for grabs. The website address is scienceinsport.com/thecyclingpodcast. I'll do that again because people have been struggling to hear. It's scienceinsport.com/thecyclingpodcast.
Hang on, Lionel, stop press. Our host is about to tell us what we're going to eat tonight.
Ciao. Allora abbiamo i nostri affettati.
Cured meats.
Poi abbiamo insalata russa.
Red salad.
Cestino in pasta sfoglia con verdure grigliate.
A basket of flaked pasta with... Now it's getting a bit more complicated.
Poi abbiamo uno sformato di spinaci con salsa al tartufo.
This is going to get long. I think we need to carry on.
Spinach and... I got it spinach and truffle. Excellent. Spinach and truffle I got there.
Yeah. It all sounds excellent.
Sounding good.
Poi abbiamo agnolotti classici alla tortona.
La tortona...
Con fondo d'arrosto.
Okay, so agnolotti filled pasta with like roasted meat inside.
E un risotto con asparagi.
Asparagus risotto.
Wow.
Is it a... La tagliata di fassone piemontese.
And then tagliata, thin beef. There's a lot. It could be a long night.
Dolce, vino, caffè, grappa.
Excellent. Lionel, let's wrap it up.
You can't see this, but I'm actually punching the air here. Daniel, we'd better get on with it because my mind is completely distracted
by
dinner.
Talking of food, Lionel, I should stick my hand up. I should fess up because I had a shocker yesterday. Not the first time I got something wrong, but the Bolognese, I was convinced that the Bolognese themselves, the people of Bologna, never referred to, for example, spaghetti Bolognese. However, I was wrong. I thought they ragu was a generic term and that covered everything. That covered Bolognese. But apparently they do use that. They do talk about Bolognese sauce, which shocked me.
Well, I was there when you were this news was delivered to you by...
From Pierre Maolini, very good friend and a long-term, long-standing colleague of mine, a photographer from Piedmont, but a real gastronome, really knows his stuff as far as food's concerned.
Yeah, he actually, while explaining this, he's a photographer, so he rides on a motorbike, doesn't he? And while explaining this, he actually slammed the lid of the case on the back of his motorbike. And I was, again, punching the air because I got something right about Italian culture and food, and 1-0 to me yesterday. Anyway, Daniel,
talking of having a bad day, Simon Geschke had a bad day yesterday, almost as bad as mine. Let's hear why, shall we?
How is it possible that a World Tour team was supposed to be at the top level of professionalism and they forget a rider, and a good rider as well?
I couldn't believe it either, and I wasn't even late, so...
A German would never be late.
No, it was 1 minute early, so exactly the time. I was ready when we had to be ready, but they just left without me because, they all went in the bus, they all were tired apparently already. And they looked back and yeah, let's just go. And I thought everyone was there, but I wasn't. I was still in the room. Yeah, then I had to make some calls and they sent the car back. So the bus actually didn't turn around, they just continued and they sent the car back for me.
Is this because everyone's so focused on the pink jersey and Tom?
Of course the focus, but yesterday I think everyone was pretty relaxed. It was a sprinter stage. They can't blame it on being nervous. I think they were just a little bit too relaxed, and the day before was really hard, so everyone was also quite tired.
And just a tactical question on that, Simon. There was a bit of a difference of opinion about whether Movistar had ridden well or badly on the stage to Bagno di Romagna. I mean, how hard a day was it for you guys?
Yeah, really hard. We expected exactly what happened to happen, and of course the tactic of Movistar was what we expected to happen. They have two guys closing the GC with Quintana and Amador, and we thought there might be we didn't only look at Movistar but also to other teams, and we expected riders to go on the break that are closing GC, so we were ready to have a hard day, and we had, but we sort of controlled it. It was okay.
Make sure they don't forget you today, Simon.
So, Daniel, I saw the picture on social media of Simon Geschke, the Sunweb rider, alleging he'd been left behind by the team bus on the way to the start yesterday. And my cynical mind was whirring, thinking that this, no, surely not.
You were thinking fake moon landings, weren't you?
I was thinking, this is just a stunt to garner, you know, likes and shares.
Sounded genuine, sounded legit, didn't it?
Yeah, it did sound legit.
Also interesting, Simon Geschke there talking about, you know, we keep returning to this, whether Movistar did the right thing the other day by putting Anacona up the road. Geschke sort of, he said that it was a predictable tactic. They weren't taken by surprise, but it was still a hard day. Anyway, all of this is going to be irrelevant tomorrow, isn't it, on Europa, because we've got, the next big mountain top finish, the start of the big sort out. Do you know what? Vincenzo Nibali said tonight that he thinks Tom Dumoulin is the favourite to win the stage tomorrow. And I kind of agree with him, because it's not a long climb. It's another one of those sort of half-hour efforts, 40-minute efforts, very much like a time trial. Dumoulin could see attacking with a kilometre, 2 kilometres to go, and extending his advantage in the general classification.
It's going to be very interesting, isn't it? Because it's the easiest finish of the week, the easiest summit finish of the week. And then there's a really tricky Tour of Lombardy type, Il Lombardia type finish in Bergamo on Sunday, which could be the one that really undoes somebody, because it's steep and tricky, isn't it? Those couple of climbs at the end. And then after that, it is pure beastly mountains. I mean, those two Tuesday and Wednesday stages in excess of 210 kilometres are real beastly difficult days. It's almost like everything just tightens up bit by bit, doesn't it? And it all starts at Europa tomorrow.
It does, Lionel. I'm just looking at the stats for the climb. It's 11.8 kilometres, 6.2% average. So it's fairly rolling. It's what the Italians call a climb that's pedalabile. You can get a good rhythm on it. But a very famous incident, a very famous episode from Giro history occurred on that climb at Europa in 1999. Let's hear a little bit more about it.
Colba, appena linea. Sì, sono proprio alle spalle della maglia rosa. È stata l'assistenza Shimano a dargli la bicicletta. Adesso è arrivato anche Beppe.
Hi, I'm Marco Velo. I was teammate Pantani in 99 when he won in Europa. Ma ormai le immagini si vedono.
Now we've all seen the film many times, I think. I have great memories of that day. Marco had a mechanical problem. He dropped his chain. And the rest of us took a while to realise. We finally dropped back, and I remember Marco getting angry with us because we were trying to pull him back to the bunch too quickly. We were going really fast and kept leaving him 10, 15 minutes adrift. Obviously, once he'd caught everyone and won, we joked about it, because he'd pulled off one of the greatest exploits in recent cycling history. He caught and passed so many riders, which on an explosive climb like that one was almost mission impossible. Marco himself didn't know he'd won because he didn't have a radio and hadn't kept track of who he'd passed. That made it even more beautiful. I've been back there a few times since, but I don't deny that tomorrow my thoughts will drift back to that day.
L'ho già fatto altre volte dopo Europa, sicuramente non nego che il pensiero comunque andrà quel giorno.
In vista del traguardo finale, eccolo là in fondo al rettilineo, ancora sui pilali, scatta ancora Pantan.
So that was the very, very famous 1999 stage to Europa. Lionel, you know, we know what the postscript was. We know that Pantani a week later effectively got kicked out of the Giro when he had it already won for high hematocrit on the eve of the final, on the penultimate day. It doesn't really alter the fact that it was one of the most dramatic moments, certainly in recent Giro history. Pantani, I think it's been exaggerated, it's been embellished, and I remember writing a feature about exactly what did happen that day, and he didn't overtake 100 riders or 120 riders, which has been written, I think it was 50 or so, but still it made for remarkable television. You heard Marco Velo there talking about it's one of the great exploits of Giro history. I think what we know about Pantani and what we know about perhaps what was behind his performances make us slightly cautious about qualifying in those terms, but certainly the drama was undeniable.
Well, it was, Daniel, and it's all set up for something remarkable to happen tomorrow, isn't it? There are people who need to make up some time. I'm wondering about Adam Yates. You asked him this morning whether or not he's still got the GC in mind, and his answer was...
Let's hear from him.
Adam, I understand you've taken the decision to keep going for GC. Was that an easy decision? Was it a no-brainer, really?
No-brainer, really. I mean, yeah, I lost 4 minutes, but... Or whatever, I lost 4 minutes 40. But the Giro is a long race. We still got how many stages left, and they're all pretty much mountain stages other than today, so why would we change anything?
How quickly did you get over a body blow like the one you took the other day?
I was pretty lucky, really. I didn't get too injured, just my knees and my hip. I'm all good.
Well, there we are. So it's all set up for people to go forwards and people to go backwards. This time tomorrow, it could all look different.
And we're lurching dangerously towards
speculation. I know. One thing that is not speculation is that it's nearly dinner time. I feel I ought to go and dress for dinner, given the number of courses we've got. Tomorrow morning, we'll head to Castellania, Fausto Coppi's birthplace. His house, the house he grew up in is there. We'll try and go and have a look at that. The family winery is there,
yeah,
too. Try and have a look at that.
Probably some Monferrato Rosso, which we will also hopefully be sampling this evening. Maybe.
Mm. And then the race heads off into the mountains again. So we will discuss all of that in tomorrow's episode. That's Saturday. I lose track of days. It's the weekend. If you're sort of catching up with what we've been doing here on the Cycling Podcast, don't miss Kilometre Zero. A couple of interesting episodes, hopefully, that you might enjoy. One about the double, the phenomenon of whether anyone can win the Giro and the Tour in the same year. And then I did a kind of, a love letter to the Giro, very brief celebration of all things that are great about the Giro d'Italia. That came out this morning. And
Lionel, one of the things that's great about the Giro, or has been great about the Giro this year, has been our listeners. So thank you very much to everyone who has supported us and sent us some fantastic messages over the last few days. We appreciate it immensely.
We certainly do. We get a lot of comments on social media. Just because we don't necessarily reply to everybody doesn't mean we haven't read and appreciated them. So
we're too busy eating.
I don't want to give that impression, Daniel. But anyway, another day, another meal. So until tomorrow, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Liza.
A reminder that you can watch the Giro d'Italia live and exclusive on Eurosport and Eurosport Player. UK viewers can also watch highlights of each stage at 10 p.m. on free-to-air channel Quest. There's a special offer for the Eurosport Player, £29.99 for an all-access pass for the rest of 2017. Details of availability, compatible devices and full terms and conditions can be found on the Eurosport Player website, uk.eurosportplayer.com. You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Thanks to them, and thanks to our other sponsors, Science and Sport and Maserati, and to All Press Espresso for supporting our morning show, Kilometre Zero. The music in this episode is by Amara Terra. Thanks to them. Thanks to those who helped keep us on the road, in particular David Luxon, Jonathan Rowe, Nick Christian, and Simon Gill. And thanks to John Mooney, who produced this episode.